I spent an entire summer on the farm, and recall that time as the happiest of my life. The farm was paradise, a playground where my imagination could go wild. At night I listened to crickets instead of creaking beds and moans, and in the morning I woke to the sound of roosters crowing and the smell of hot biscuits and fresh brewed coffee. My grandpa, Bob Thomas, allowed me to help with the chores, which gave me a sense of purpose I didn't have at home. In addition to farming, he drove a garbage truck. He hauled rubbish to the dump he owned next to the farm. That dump was the site of numerous adventures. At night, for instance, I took a .22, wandered down to the dump, pretending that I was a cowboy or soldier, and waited for some big motherfucking rats to come out. Then I opened fire. Ka-choo, ka-choo! Yes, sir, I fucked up some rats. My mother didn't stay single for long. After she remarried, she asked me why I didn't call her new husband Daddy. He's your father, she said. You call him that or I'll beat your ass. But he ain't my daddy, I argued. That pissed her off even more. Well, you call that other woman Mom. The other woman was Viola Hurst, and my mother was right about the fact I called her Mom. I don't know why I did that, but my daddy and I were going to see Sugar Ray Robinson fight in Chicago, and on the way he surprised me by stopping next door at China B's house to pick up Viola. I watched her get into the car and thought she was very sexy. This is my son Richard, he said. Hello there, Viola smiled. Hi, Mom, I said. It's strange I called her that. But the night before, I'd overheard Gertrude tell my dad that she thought I was nuts. I didn't know why she said that, nor did I ask anyone for an explanation. So many things were impossible to understand that, after a certain point, you just quit trying. You dealt with the facts with survival. You didn't trust anybody. You watched your back. You covered your ass. You said whatever you had to say to stay out of trouble. On television, people talked about having happy lives, but in the world in which I grew up, happiness was a moment rather than a state of being. It buzzed around just out of reach like Tinkerbell, flirting and teasing and laughing at your ass. It never stayed long enough for you to get to know it good. Just a taste here and there, a kiss, a sniff, a stroke, a snort. Yet those were the moments I learned to chase. I remember the first time I had an orgasm. Because when you first started jacking off, you didn't come. You just had that funny feeling. In fact, the first time I came, I thought something was wrong with me. Said to my dick, "Oh, shit, look what you've done to me." An hour later, I was back, Jack. Asked my dick, "Can you do it again?" It's only natural for a young boy of 10 to think about sex, but living in a whorehouse gave me special access to those mysteries of the flesh that elude most people until they're older. I spied through the keyholes, putting my eye to the little opening every chance I got. I bumped my head a lot, but I also got an education you couldn't get in school. Once I saw my own mother in bed with a man, white dude. She didn't seem to mind, but it fucked me up. Tricks used to come through our neighborhood. That's where I first met white people. They came down to our neighborhood and helped the economy. I could have been a bigot, you know what I mean? I could have been prejudiced. I met nice white men. They said, "Hello, little boy. Is your mother home? I'd like a blowjob." I wonder what would happen if niggas went to white neighborhoods doing that shit. "Hey, man. Your mama home. Tell the bitch we want to fuck." Prostitutes sat in the big picture window and waved to customers. All sorts. Whites and blacks, businessmen, politicians, junkies. I spent a lot of time sitting with them, yakking, laughing, and bullshitting. God, there were some characters. Like Mary. She was a real honest-to-goodness hermaphrodite. Had a pussy and a dick. That shit fucked me up. But she didn't mind. People asked what her name was, and she said, They call me Coffee because I grind so fine. I never had nothing to do with her other than laughing a hell of a lot. She was a funny lady. But as soon as some guy entered, those women's kicked me out, closed the door, and went to work. It was weird. I remember a white dude used to come down and ask, "Do you have any girls who will cover you with ice cream and little boys that'll lick it off?" And he was the mayor. They had me run to the store to get them tampons. I cleaned up in the bathrooms and stuff and found all their women shit around. You know, that's when I decided women are nasty motherfuckers. Then my dick came to life, started thinking for itself, bossing me around. I discovered masturbating when I was about 9 or 10. I was in the tub and said, "Hey, I'm on to something here. Shit, I bet Dad don't know about this." After that, they couldn't keep my ass out of the tub. I never got to scooch any of the whores, but they sure made my dick hard, swear to God. One time I crawled up into a vent that looked into one of the upstairs rooms where one of Mama's whores had brought a John. Shit, they attacked each other, humping and pumping with a furiousness I'd never imagined. I got so involved watching him suck her pussy that I took the vent out and stuck my head out into the room. Tricks would be fucking right. They'd be, oh, God, golly, ma'am, is it really good? Is it really good? And the whores be going, "Oh, it's good, baby. Oh, God damn it. Oh, shit, damn. There ain't nobody like you, baby. Oh, God damn." Years later, I got to be with the same prostitute, and I told her the story. "No, I didn't see you, baby," she said. "I saw you," I smiled mischievously. Then I pointed to the vent. I was right up there. She didn't even open her eyes. "Go ahead. Tell me about it, baby, as you suck on my pussy." Girls mystified me, man. Scared the crap out of me. I don't know, maybe I thought I was ugly or stupid or something. When I was a teenager, I didn't get nothing from the girls. Some of the cool guys could get something all the time. Remember those guys? They could say, "Bitch," and all the girls would melt. I said that and got an ass whooping. I lost my virginity courtesy of Mr. Spinks. Spinks was a local player, a pimp and dealer. He defined the word jive. He lived with this beautiful lady named Penny, who reminded me of Ava Gardner and often crept into my horny imagination. One day I ventured over to their place, knowing that Spinks was out doing his things and that I could have Penny all to myself. I didn't expect to do anything more than talk and do weird, disgusting things to her in my mind. I wasn't alone with her for 10 minutes before Penny asked me to do some of that stuff I was thinking about. Feel her titties, grab her ass. As I complied, my dick showed its appreciation. But I didn't know what to do once I got to that point, which was embarrassing. "You never fucked anyone before, honey," she asked, "did you?" I shook my head no. Never mind getting into a girl's panties. I'd never been in one's house. Fathers kicked ass in my neighborhood. They talked to us on the porch. "Say, boy, what's your name, Jenkins? Let me tell you something, boy. You stay away from my house. See, I worked too hard to send my girls to school to get an education, and not the kind you wants to give them. Now, if I catch you around here, I'm going to take this bad leg off and wear your ass out with it." "Come on over here," Penny said. "I'm going to show you what they do when the doors are shut." And she did. She said, "Just put it in there. Yeah, right there. Now up and down. You now." I did what she said. "Yeah, baby," she continued. "Go up and down, don't stop." She fucked me good. Afterward, I understood why that man had been on top of my mother. Getting the pussy just like me. Then Spinks came home. I was in the bathroom when I heard the door open and close. Then I heard him say hi to Penny. Oh, shit. He wanted to make small talk. He asked what was going on. I listened my ear to the door as I pulled on the rest of my clothes and wondered how I was going to get the fuck out. But I couldn't move. I was too scared. Come on out of there, Spinks said. Was he talking to me? Then I heard pounding on the bathroom door.
Rich, get the hell out of there.
I didn't say a word.
Listen, boy, get the fuck out.
I prepared to get clobbered, maybe even killed. Then I opened the door and braced for the worst. After nothing hit me, I slowly opened my eyes. Spinks and Penny were on the sofa, staring at me. Their grins were the size of Chevys. The embarrassment I felt then was even worse than not knowing what to do with my boner. Hi, I said sheepishly. Thanks, I gotta go. See ya. Thinking about it now, I can see that Spinks probably told her to do that to me. Not that I'm complaining, you know. 6. My folks gave me a chance at something better by putting me in Catholic school, where I thrived. I made friends. I got straight A's. I showed promise. The teachers were impressed. They thought I was smart and encouraged me to aim high. Then someone found out about the family business, and that blew my chance. They gave me the boot, kicked my ass out into the cold. I was crushed by this inexplicable rejection by people who professed love and forgiveness. Why'd they kick me out of school? I asked my grandma. What did I do? Nothing, baby, she said. Some people just don't know right from wrong, even though they think they wrote the book. Mama left it to me to discover that the world overflowed with hypocrisy, and it didn't take long. Despite being expelled from Catholic school, I was forced by my stepmother to continue going to catechism on weekends. On Saturday, a priest came on to me like a girlfriend. He snuck up on me and gave me a smooch on the lips. I ran home bawling and heaving the whole way, especially hard as I told and retold the story. See, I was in church, I explained, and the guy there gave me some smooches. Where? My daddy asked. On the lips. Where were you? My Uncle Dickie asked. In the church. Now who kissed you, baby? My grandma wanted to know. You said a man kissed you. Yeah, the priest. Black preachers know God personally. Say, you know, I first met God in 1929, outside a little hotel in Baltimore. I was walking down the street eating a tuna fish sandwich. In 1929, you ate anything you could get. And I heard this voice call unto me. And the voice had power and majesty. And the voice said, "Psst." And I walked up to the voice and said, "What?" And the voice got magnificent and holy, and it resounded, "Give me some of that sandwich." I knew it was serious when everyone gasped after I identified the molester as a priest. "What else, honey?" "Well, Mama, after he kissed me, he said that he'd like to call me someday." I saw my dad and Uncle Dickie past the point of being angry. Both held back laughter. "And what did you say?" I said, "Call me tonight, later tonight." "Then I ran like hell," I said. The next move was debated. My grandma and some aunties wanted to let it blow over, but my dad and uncle realized that they could probably get some money by blackmailing the priest. They hatched a plan. If the priest called, they told me to goad him into making incriminating comments. They'd listen on another extension. They also told me to arrange a meeting at which they would surprise the priest and demand money. "We'll collar him," my dad punned. I was excited by the scam, but more so by suddenly being the center of attention. I also liked thinking about the monies my dad and uncle said we'd get. I thought that I might also get a cut and use it to go to the baseball games or the movies. buy my way into the big time. Later that night, the phone rang. My dad and uncle ran for the extensions. I nervously did my thing.
Hi, baby,
I purred in the soft, seductive voice they told me to use.
Oh, my little doll,
the priest said. I heard the excitement in his voice. We cooed sweet nothings back and forth like that for a few minutes. I sensed my dad and uncle's scheme working. Suddenly, my grandmother heard what was going on and called a halt to the charade from her bedroom.
Don't do that to the boy,
she hollered. Her loud, booming, angry voice threw me off the script and ended my lovey-dovey conversation with the priest before the crucial meeting was set. My dad and uncle scrambled into the kitchen. They made me promise to call him back. But then Grandma Marie yelled for us to get our ass into her bedroom and asked what the hell we were up to. My father and Dickie denied everything, but I caved.
Mama, I don't want to do this,
I said. Mama shook her head in disgust and ordered us to put an end to the scheming. It was disappointing. We had the priest hooked. However, she wanted us to throw him back as if he was a small bass. Then she urged forgiveness.
Richard, my grandmother said, you've got to understand that everybody's human.
Yes, Mama.
Don't ever forget it, she continued. No matter what they are, everybody's human.
For a young black boy, that statement was hard to believe. It was clear that some people believed that they were more human than others. At my new school, Irving Elementary, I developed a crush on a little girl. She happened to be white. She could have been any color, it didn't matter to me. I just liked her. One day, as a token of my affection, I gave her a scratch board, the kind on which you scribble pictures and then lift up the plastic paper to erase the drawing. She promised to take it home and make it her favorite toy. I was pleased. The next day, her father showed up at school holding the toy. He looked mean. You weren't supposed to look at fourth graders like that. He asked the teacher which little nigger had given his daughter the scratch pad. She pointed to me, and he ran straight up to me.
Nigger, don't you ever give my daughter anything, he yelled.
That really put me back. What the fuck had I done? Why was he calling me a nigger? Why did he hate me? I mean, I knew it was because I was black, but still, I didn't know why. That shit is stuff that people like my grandmother warned me about. I also overheard others telling stories, nervously exchanging anecdotes and such, but you don't believe it until you're actually confronted by it, like a hold-up or attack. You see it on the news every night, figuring it's always going to happen to someone else, never you. Then some dude steps in your face and calls you a nigger. If I was 4.5 feet tall then, the girl's daddy cut 6 inches off. Zap. 6 inches of self-esteem gone. That was my indoctrination to the black experience in America. They don't teach that shit in school. But I'd learned, as every African American does to some degree, that such degradation and assault to one's dignity has gone on since the slave ships brought black people from Africa to this land of equality and opportunity. I couldn't figure out why the teacher didn't defend me. She didn't say a word. My dad went to school the next day and confronted her. I'd never seen him so angry. I loved that he was defending me.
How could you do that? He asked. How could you not say anything to that man?
The teacher looked down. She shook her head, showing that she, too, was disgusted. At the man. At herself. My daddy gently patted her on the back. They reached some kind of understanding. Then he turned to the little girl I tried to befriend.
Did you get his present? He asked.
Yes, she sniffled. But he wouldn't let me keep it.
That's okay, I chimed in. Or so I said. But I didn't mean it. My brain didn't segregate people by race. My eyes didn't see any one color. One of my favorite activities was going to the movies, where I lost myself in the fantasy projected on screen. My heroes included Tarzan, Rhonda Fleming, Milton Berle, Kirk Douglas, Sid Caesar, and Boris Karloff. I loved Jerry Lewis. I wanted to be John Wayne. I saw the Red Ryder cowboy serials over and over, and one time I went in the back to look for Robert Blake's Little Beaver character. I thought I'd be able to find him behind the screen, but the crew chased me out. There were only a couple theaters in Peoria that allowed black people inside. But then, having paid for tickets and popcorn the same as white people, we were restricted to sitting in the balcony. It was the same as public buses and washrooms, except the odd thing was nobody I knew seemed to mind at the theater. They liked the balcony. The view was good. It was like a party. Nobody threw shit on you. But I wanted to sit up close in the front row. You know how kids are. I wanted to feel as if I could jump into the screen. However, one afternoon, the manager grabbed my arm, yanked me from my chair, and told me I had to sit upstairs. "In the colored section," he said, "up where all you people are supposed to be." "No, I ain't gonna do that," I said. "Well, then you'll have to leave." Niggas be holding their dicks. Some white people go, "Why you guys hold your things?" Say, "You done took everything else, motherfucker." I loved the movies. The manager didn't give me a choice. I knew what was what. So I left. 7. At 12 years old, I transferred to Blaine Sumner, a primarily white school. By then, I'd given up on acquiring an education. After all, I'd been raped, expelled, abused, and victimized by the sting of racism. What more was there to learn? I couldn't lie to my old man because he could hypnotize me. He heard my mind. Checked me right out. "Say, man, are you fucking up in school?" he asked. "Huh?" "Yes, I am. In class, I let my motor idle. Between bells, I wondered if my teachers were good fucks. Stuff like that. I also jacked off. A lot of people didn't jack off. I used to jack off so much, I knew pussy couldn't be as good as my hand. My friend Andy and I had secret jack-off contests at our desks, though one time in art class, our X-rated antic wasn't as private as I thought. After the bell, someone pointed out that all the desks had a front, except for mine. Everyone in the class had watched. "Ain't this a bitch," I said. And here I thought I was being slick. I witnessed salvation come to people in a number of ways. Drugs, gambling, women, and alcohol. And though I wouldn't say I was saved by Marguerite Yinkst Parker, one of my teachers at Blaine, she did give me a shove in the right direction. Miss Parker was an attractive woman who had a pretty daughter about my age. I joked that I wanted to get together with her. "Maybe we'll get married," I told my teacher. "Then you and I will be family." "Oh, Richard," Miss Parker said sweetly. What set Miss Parker apart from the rest was her ability to handle me. She did it with kindness and patience, a combination that's always slayed me. Ordinarily, I acted dumb in front of my teachers, but Miss Parker refused to believe my performances, no matter how convincing. "I guess I'm too retarded for that," I whined. Miss Parker always laughed at my silliness. Then she sat me down, assured me that I wasn't as dumb as I said, and in a gentle, sweet, reassuring voice, she goaded me into at least trying to learn something. In truth, she blackmailed me. If I would make an attempt at working, she said, then she would permit me to stand in front of the class each morning and tell jokes. The deal was irresistible. My routine was always something I'd picked up from a TV show. Red Skelton, Jerry Lewis, Sid Caesar. Sometimes I imitated friends. Other times I risked impressions of the school's teachers and bullies, who all of us knew were assholes. I never thought of myself as having a gift. but I made my classmates laugh, and when I heard their laughter, I felt good about myself, which was a pretty rare feeling. But nice. Real nice. By high school, I tried running with gangs, but I was tough for about half a minute. That was it. I was in every gang in Peoria. They had about five. I was in all of them. Whichever one was winning. That's my side. The real tough guys hung out at Proctor, a recreation center where they spent all day practicing how to be criminals. Fighting, rolling dice, drinking. Guys showed up at noon and hung around all day, waiting for the cops to come. The scared poot butts like me went to Carver Center, a safe haven thanks to the effort, vision, and devotion of Juliet Whitaker. A tiny young lady, she might have been the toughest soul in Peoria. She didn't take shit from anybody. People who didn't even know her respected her for having something most others didn't, an education. She was a black woman who came from good parents and had gone to college. That was something downright inspirational. More so, instead of leaving for better neighborhoods that had higher-paying jobs, Miss Whitaker stayed in Peoria. She had beliefs about doing good, a conviction that she could help kids like me realize their dreams, if they dared to dream in the first place. She was good. I picked up on that. Although Miss Whitaker reminded me of a toad, I saw the beauty inside her. Her smile made you forget about things. That's beauty. I proposed to her a couple of times, but I guess I was too young for her. She just started at Carver when we met in 1951. She was in the midst of staging the play Rumpelstiltskin, and had cast all the parts except a small role of a guy who goes on stage and sneezes. It wasn't a walk-on as much as it was a walk-off. But I got it and was thrilled, especially when she gave me a script to take home and learn, though there was nothing in it for me to memorize. I learned all the parts anyway. When the kid who played the king came down with the flu, Miss Whitaker turned to me. No one in the history of the theater was more prepared to move up than I was, though my performance was unique. I modeled my portrayal of the king after my Uncle Dickie and turned the fairy tale into a black comedy. "Hey, baby," I said to the miller's daughter, "you keep on spinning that straw into gold for me and I'll get you a car. Something fine. Something for your mama. I'll make you my woman." Miss Whitaker noticed my talent, quick wit, ambition, and need. Especially my need. She began centering skits and reviews around me. I had no trouble being the center of attention and generating laughs. The spotlight suited me. In fact, I once pasted my name over Marlon Brando's on a photo of a movie marquee I cut out of the newspaper. I spent all day making up shit, practicing. It was like some kid stood on the corner and sang. I talked. My father was one of those 11 o'clock men.
"Say, where you going? Nigga, you ain't asked nobody if you could go no place."
"What? You a man now?
Okay, then get a job."
"I don't give a fuck where you're going. Be home by 11. You understand 11, don't you, nigga?
You can tell time, can't you?
11 o'clock, you bring your ass home. I don't mean down the street singing with them niggas, either. And bring me back a paper."
But nothing starts happening till 11:30. Dudes be standing around. You ask,
"What you waiting on, nigga?"
11:30? "We're gonna pitch a bitch at 11:30.
I'd have to go home with my blue nuts.
"I thought I told you to be home at 11, my dad yelled. "I don't want to hear that shit. I'm going to kick your ass."
"Can I jack off first?"
Most of the shit I said was true. I just reported on what I saw and heard, adding a twist here and there.
"Your shoes are run over so much, looks like your ankles is broke."
Shit like that. I did a character called the Rummage Sale Ranger. The Rummage Sale Ranger was a black superhero, but he was too poor to have his own shit. He had to go to the rummage sale, find some woman's tights, steal a fucking cape because he was out of change, shoes that were too big. Nothing fit right, Kids at the center loved the shit. The material flowed from my mouth without stop, which was a problem for some. Like Mr. Fink, my science teacher. But I gave him reason. Mr. Fink was serious about teaching. I sat in the back row and entertained my neighbors as if I was at the comedy store working out a new routine. One day he got so fed up, he grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and took me downstairs. Just to show I had a sense of humor, I took a swing at him. That was it. He opened the front door to the school and literally threw my ass on the ground, out of school. "Don't come back," he said. The door slammed shut with a loud bang. I knew there was no use arguing my way back inside. It was as if school was a train ride, and the conductor was talking to me.
"Eighth grade, end of the line."
"Oh, shit," I said out loud. And then I thought about my folks. What were they going to say? "Fuck," I said. "Now I've got to go home and deal with those people." 8. Everybody listened to what happened. My grandmother, my dad, Viola, my aunts and uncles. They then taught me the lesson you learn after leaving school. "It's okay," my dad said, "but I'll tell you this. If you don't put nothing in the pot, you don't get nothing out." Dinner that night was my last free meal. The next day, I began looking for a job. As a 14-year-old high school dropout, I had low expectations. I begged local shop owners, and eventually I got a job cleaning a strip club, sweeping and mopping. My problem was that I liked the show more than I did the work. The club's owner complained to Uncle Dickie, who confronted me. "He says, the girls lay down on the stage and get all dirty," Dickie explained to me. "What's the matter, boy?" "I can do the sweeping," I said, "but I can't do no mopping. My arm's too skinny." Next, I shined shoes at the Pierre Marquette Hotel. I enjoyed that. I thought I was numero uno. I made the shine cloth crack like a bullwhip, told jokes. The money was easy and the conversation good. But I fell in with some bad guys who persuaded me there was an easier way to make money, by stealing it. One afternoon, we targeted a small grocery store in the neighborhood. As one guy went in and distracted the owner, another guy and I opened the cash register and grabbed the coins from the box. Nothing fancy. Plain old till-tapping. Except I dropped the coins. My friends ran. The owner calmly walked toward me, shaking his head in disgust.
"Boy, what the hell are you doing?" he yelled.
I froze and saw my future.
"We've got your son down here at headquarters. What about it?"
"Fuck him."
I'd be praying something would happen to him on the way down to the station, but he always showed up. "I'm going to get you out, nigga, but then I'm going to kick your ass." My hands went straight up. There was nothing in them. I did one of those looks that said, "Who, me?"
"Yes, nigger, I'm talking to you. Put that money back."
I put the coins back real nice, as if that would make it like nothing ever happened.
"I'm gonna tell your daddy," he threatened.
My so-called friends stood outside looking through the window and laughing.
"And don't come back here no more," the owner added.
That hurt, because that was my local store. I went there all the time. About then, Dickie was picked up for dope and went to jail. I remember when the cops got him. He was holding a big box of counterfeit money. Right before they cuffed him, he set it on top of a garbage can. Real calm. They never bothered to check it. He went to prison in Michigan. He did about 3 years and came out a changed man. He said to me, "Richard, I can only tell you one thing about prison."
"What's that?"
"Don't ever go."
After racking balls at Pop's pool hall and driving a truck for my dad's karting business, I finally got my first serious job at one of the local packing companies. I shook and folded hides and loaded them on the trains that took them to Chicago, where they were turned into shoes, coats, bags, and shit. It was nasty work. All the shit that got on me during the day, the rock salt, water, and whatnot, froze in the cold. By quitting time, my pants were as stiff as a board. But the job was mine. I made monies. I had the jingle jangle of possibilities in my pocket. One day I heard about a better paying position cutting beef. I went upstairs to where they did that shit to investigate. However, as soon as I saw guys hitting the fucking bulls in the head with sledgehammers, I knew I couldn't handle it. Neither could I handle dealing with those bulls while they were alive. As I stood there, one of them escaped. Guess he had other ideas. I saw him look at that sledgehammer and say, "What? Excuse me, what's going on?" Suddenly, he charged out of his stall, ran through the shop upstairs and downstairs, snorting and kicking and butting everything in his path. Then he got outside. The police finally had to shoot this motherfucker because he was running down the street with one thing on his mind. What motherfucker ordered steak? I spent about half my pay at Yakov's liquor store, where I ate pickled pig's feet, drank ice-cold beer, and bullshitted about the future. I didn't expect to stay employed at the packing company forever. Eventually, I figured on buying a pair of steel-toed shoes and punching a clock at the Caterpillar Tractor Company. Work, pension, die. In between, I'd get fucked up and watch TV and chase pussy. Getting some pussy beats anything. I ain't lying. Coming is a lot of fun. I never got no pussy when I was a legal teenager. You had to sing to get pussy. Be one of those niggas on the corner who sang. I couldn't sing. Besides, the girls weren't given no pussy in the 50s. It was very seldom you got any parts of pussy. You'd be tongue-kissing, and your dick got harder than the times in 29. Nuts would go up into your stomach, and you said, "Oh, baby, you gotta give me something now." "I'm not giving anything," she said. "I'm on my period." "You're on your period again? You're gonna bleed to death, bitch." 17, I started fucking regularly. One was an attractive little package. She and I used to hide out in the garage of a house my family owned on Goodwin. It wasn't the Playboy Mansion, but it was kind of our private place. It was pure fun. I used to wrestle with her for 2 hours. That's when those rubber panties came out. Those long rubber panties. And every time I'd get a grip, she'd move and I'd lose my grip and have to wrestle 2 more hours. And by the time I'd got them, I was too tired. "I'll see you tomorrow." Then her father would catch us. There'd be a knock at the door. "What are you doing here, Mr. Pryor?" "Oh, nothing. Just sitting here on the couch with my pants off." I fell in love with that girl. Fell hard. But then I loved falling in love. Looking back, that turned out to be my curse. Falling in love, you know. It was never enough. In late 1956, she took all the fun out of what we had going. She said she was pregnant. For a moment, I thought the baby was mine. But she had slept with lots of people, including my dad. 9 months later, she gave birth to a little girl. My Aunt Maxine reassured me that the baby wasn't mine. This was revelatory. A weight off my back. I was like, "Oh, somebody else claimed it," she said. "Yeah, I was out in the chicken shack and someone else said it was his baby." That was all the excuse I needed. The little girl grew up with her mother and grandmother in Peoria. I saw her occasionally, and eventually we got to know each other. Not an ideal relationship, just a fact of life. In 1958, I volunteered for the Army. I asked myself why I did something like that, a chicken shit like me. I was serving my country. It was either that or 6 months. I wanted out of Peoria. I wanted to see something different. No place in particular. Just beyond, you know? I took the train to Chicago, went to the induction office, and spent the day taking tests. I must have done okay because right after, I was sworn in. They gave me a free round-trip train ticket that got me home and back to Chicago. To me, that was exciting shit. Basic training was at Fort Leonard Wood in Missouri. I received 8 weeks of plumbing school. Once again, I was covered in shit. I went to kill class. Turned me around. I thought the Army was like hunting, camping, a little fishing. But I learned to kill from a guy who killed in World War II, and then they couldn't stop him. So they gave him a job. Ain't let him on the streets, so we'll let him train these guys for World War III. Then my papers came in, and I was transferred to Idar-Oberstein in Germany. For an 18-year-old who'd never been farther than Springfield or Bloomington, it was exciting. Idar-Oberstein sounded like an exotic woman. Then reality. I called my sergeant and told him I was on my way to the base. "I'm so happy you're coming," he said. "Thank you, sir," I said. "Yeah," he laughed. "I've been working with a nigger for the last 3 years." "Uh-oh," I thought. "Yes, sir," I said. "Well, I'm glad I'm here too, sir. Yes, sir." I expected Germany to be a little freer, but the Fräuleins were skinny rather than fat, and when I ventured to the section where all the bars were located, I found that out of like 150 bars, only 3 let in blacks. Why should you have been surprised, Rich? Well, I was, because I thought all that shit was behind me. Unfortunately, I met a woman whose boyfriend was a bartender in one of the white bars, and one night I went there. Her boyfriend, who usually called the MPs on me, wasn't working that night, so I had a chance. But before I ordered my first beer, a fight broke out between 2 U.S. soldiers, and before I knew it, I heard someone cry out, "Nigger!" I glanced around. There was no one else of any color there but me. I ran upstairs with a stripper's changed clothes, begging the first girl I saw to help. She gave me a look of hate that I knew too well from back home. "Get out of here," she said in a heavily accented voice. "You don't understand. They're fighting down there. Get out of here. I call police." The MPs arrived at the same time I snuck outside and ran back to the barracks. I never forgot that stripper, though. Of course, you never forget the cruel ones. But there were other kinder women, thank God. My kind of women. The kind who like to fuck. This one woman let me give her head, which was a revelation. Something that changed my life, because until then, my family only fucked in one position. Up and down. My uncle has said, "Boy, don't you ever kiss no pussy. I mean that. Whatever you do in life, don't kiss no pussy." I couldn't wait to kiss the pussy. He'd been wrong about everything else. Woman had to beat me off. "It's enough. It's enough. 2 days. Eventually, the Army turned me into a vicious killing machine. The transformation occurred in full one weekend night as our unit watched the movie Imitation of Life. This white soldier laughed at the wrong spots. Several of us finally took exception, including a big black soldier who got into a slugfest with the white guy. But my guy was a dumb motherfucker in terms of fighting. The white boy seriously hurt my guy's ass. A crowd gathered. People wanted blood. We'd spent months training for combat, but this turned into the biggest battle anyone had come close to, and I knew my guy was going down if something didn't happen. From within the crowd of soldiers, I reached into my pocket and drew out a switchblade. Pushed the button. Flift! No one but me suspected anything. I waited for the right moment, then I stabbed the white motherfucker in the back 6 or 7 times. He didn't stop, though, you know? He kept throwing punches. As soon as I realized he wasn't going down, I ran the opposite direction, tossing the knife into the bushes on my way to the barracks. A while later, the white dude came in accompanied by an angry-looking MP. I peeked at the white guy's back. His T-shirt was shredded from my stabbing and soaked with blood. I thought, God damn, I did that and he didn't even stop? Didn't even feel it? Why didn't he feel it? He stared at me like that bull from the packing plant where I'd worked. Then he tore off his shirt. See what you did to me, chicken shit? He said. Wasn't me, he said. Yes, it was. You're the one. See all these holes? You're the asshole nigger who did this.
Oh, I didn't do it.
My denials meant shit. An MP threw my ass in jail. There wasn't anything in that cell except for me, the cement floor, and a single annoying light bulb. I fell onto the cot and began to think seriously about getting the fuck out of jail and the army. The base commander agreed. He was on the verge of retirement, and the last thing he wanted to deal with was a silly enlisted man fucking up regulations. I was lucky. Lucky I didn't kill that white guy, and luckier still that they didn't kill me. Because back then, the way things were, few people outside of Peoria would have missed one more dead black man. 9. I returned to Peoria speaking enough broken German to impress the local girls, but I was disappointed that I hadn't connected with the service. I had hoped to start a new career, something with more future and security than working at the packing plant or Caterpillar. Instead, I settled into the most popular career path among young, uneducated black men. Unemployment. I allowed plenty of free time for inspiration to find me. I remember seeing Red Fox and Dick Gregory on television and thinking that I could do something similar. I had no trouble making people laugh. I made a fool out of myself as good as the next guy. Did it all the time. The guys I hung out with said I was a funny motherfucker. Shit. I might as well get paid for it. I knew where to go. And one day I walked into Harold's club and asked Harold Parker, the club's owner, for work. Harold's was a black and tan club, meaning both whites and blacks went there. Harold himself was like that. He used to say he was too light to be bright. What do you do? He asked. I sing and play piano. Okay, I lied. I didn't do either, but Harold was a friend of my father's. How much you expecting to make? He asked. I answered, not much. That's good. He said, 'cause you won't. For my nightclub debut, I sat at the piano and improvised using the three or four chords I knew. I sang whatever words popped into my head. I saw that people didn't know whether I was putting them on or weird, but I put in enough time for the waitresses to serve their drinks and collect their tips. Afterward, I tried to look cool, but when Harold came up to me backstage, I still had sweat pouring off me. You've got more nerve than anybody I've ever seen, he said. Would you like to keep coming? Yes, sir, I said. I would like to do that. Harold also hired Sonny Stinson, a real singer, who brought his own band. He was the main attraction. I did my thing during their breaks. After a while, I realized that the audience responded better to my jokes than to my singing, and so, shit, I wasn't stupid. Talking was easier than making up songs. I told jokes, did impressions of Dean Martin, Jerry Lewis, and Sammy Davis Jr., and sometimes I simply picked up a book or the newspaper and read the shit in a strange voice while adding funny asides. One of my earliest bits was a takeoff on Person to Person, the TV show on which host Edward R. Murrow interviewed famous people in their homes. In my act, I wondered what might happen if, instead of talking to a celebrity, Murrow walked in on a dirt-poor black family in Mississippi.
Hi, Mr. Murrow. Just step over the chickens.
Yes, that's it. We're going to have one for dinner if you want to stay.
Yes, sir, that's our chair, and our TV, and our sofa. The wallpaper is newspaper. Put it up ourselves. That house in the back.
No, that ain't no guest house. We piss in there.
Go ahead if you need to. We'll keep the chickens back.
I was desperate to matter. I wanted to grow and bloom like the patch of sunflowers I admired as a boy. The laughter and attention I got on stage fed that desire. Then I received an additional boost. Sonny Stinson introduced me to marijuana and uppers. I never tried either. I drank, but drugs were new to me.
It's part of show business, said Sonny.
Whether or not that was true didn't matter once I tried the shit. I liked the buzz. It eased my pain and insecurity. Erased the fear. Turned me into a whole new man. Sometimes I stayed up 2 or 3 days straight feeling so cool and jive. Eventually, Sonny tired of me always asking for freebies.
You want more, it's gonna cost you, he said.
Shit, I didn't care. I loved the high, hated the crash. Said I'll take 2 instead. Stayed awake forever. Then at 2 in the morning on the 2nd or 3rd day of being awake, I'd be screaming for help.
Please, God, there's an Indian playing a drum inside me. Tell him to stop.
That's your heart.
Well, tell it to stop. Let me sleep.
Ha, ha, ha.
I was as easily hooked on women, too. My next love, Patricia, was a nice, tender little thing who reminded me of the Patricia Neal character in the movie HUD. Same name, same situation. She probably shouldn't have gotten involved with a confused young comedian who didn't have a plan, but, hey, I made about $50 a week, and I thought that was good, you know? For us, it was. But in 1960, I didn't know certain stuff. Patricia got pregnant. I felt responsible, which might have been the first and last time I did. But my dad told me flat out I didn't have to marry her. You don't have to do this, son, he said. Yes, I did. Just to spite him, I did. Jeez, I was a sick puppy. Patricia and I married in the little corner house on Goodwin. My grandmother, Dad, and Viola were among those who attended the event. It came when Richard Jr. was born, too. At the hospital, I stared at him for the longest time. He looked like a little ape. And when I told my dad that, he laughed.
So did you. He said, like a little gorilla. That's what Mama said about you.
Yeah, I muttered. Then I guess he's mine. But that was about all. After Richard Jr. was born, Pat and I quit living together. Why'd I split? Because I could. 10. By 1962, I also started performing at Collins Corner, another black and tan nightclub, though it was actually more black than tan. The club's owner, Briss Collins, promoted me from opening act to MC, which paid between $70 and $100 a week, and gave me an excuse to hang out with the headliner, a pretty girl from St. Louis who could sing her ass off. She had a big act that included dancers and backup singers. Most of whom I discovered were transvestites, men dressing up as girls. I was greatly relieved to find a few real females. One sang, one danced, and one had a sister who looked more like a brother. I always thought she was a man. Then one night she gave me some pussy. I swear I thought she was going to pull out some kind of dick. But she didn't. She liked me. I listened to them tell stories of playing the different black-owned clubs in the Midwest that formed the Black Belt Circuit, and dreamed of hitting the road just as they did. It was my way out. Maybe one day I'll MC a rock and roll show, I said to Briss Collins. That day came sooner than I imagined. One day my woman, this whore who'd been given to me by my dad, told me to beat her. I didn't know what she was talking about, but she screamed, "Hit me! Hit me!" Well, I didn't know that when a woman told you to hit her, you weren't supposed to go crazy. But I went crazy. I started fighting as if it was a real fight. Bruised and hurt, She ran to my father. It looked as if he might beat me.
What the fuck are you doing? He yelled. You don't know how to beat a whore.
But she said to hit her, I explained.
Get out of here, he said.
What? I asked, realizing he was serious about kicking me out of the house.
What did you say?
Get your ass out of here. I hadn't planned on such a hasty departure, but I had no choice. I grabbed some clothes, some cash, and a little alto saxophone, which I later pawned to buy groceries, and walked in a swirl of confusion over to Colin's corner. I didn't know what I was going to do or where I was going to go, only that I wasn't going to stick around Peoria. As I slammed the door behind me, I said, "You'll see, motherfucker. Someday you'll see." At Colin's corner, I told both the guys who were girls and the real girls what had happened. They invited me to travel with them to East St. Louis, where they were booked into the Faust Club, a club on the Black Belt Circuit. I couldn't believe my luck. One minute, kicked out of the house, no prospects. The next, I was on the road in show business. I was too raw for the Faust Club, whose acts were all experienced. The club's MC watched me for a few times and tried to help. My routines weren't bad, he said, but my delivery was. You've got to talk to the people, he said. You always look like you want to kill them. Persuade them. Okay. When my friends moved on, I was left to fend for myself. But I had picked up on how the system worked from other performers, particularly from one dancer. She had given me the mystery eye and led me into her dressing room. I mentioned that I'd been in the army in Germany. She was impressed and asked what I'd done there. I learned to eat pussy, I said. Smiling, she eased back on the tattered dressing room sofa and told me that if I ate her pussy, she'd speak to the club owner at her next job and get me hired as the MC. That was how things operated. He worked a little on stage and a little off it. I also realized why they called the army the service. On the Black Belt, there were no booking agents or managers who got you jobs. Instead, the performers traded information among themselves. Strippers, musicians, dancers. They told the club owners who was good, bad, and indifferent, who liked to drink, fight, gamble, do drugs, and shit like that. There weren't a lot of options, so basically you went wherever you were wanted and hoped it worked out. Towns flew by in a blur. Cleveland, Chicago, Buffalo, and so on. I took cars, buses, trains, hitchhiked. It was hard times, but exciting times. I was going someplace else. Every day was different, a surprise, an adventure through uncharted territory. And it forced me to sharpen my skills and learn my craft just as Red Fox, Dick Gregory, Godfrey Cambridge, and other black comics had done before me. It was like going to school, especially this one funky club in Youngstown, Ohio. That's where I discovered God blessed me to be stupid enough not to know better. Everybody, it seemed, but me, knew the place was owned by shady characters. Tough guys. People who settled arguments by throwing guys off bridges and such. For real. None of these stories bothered Satin Doll, the beautiful singer who headlined the club. Then toward the end of our run, I heard her crying in her dressing room. I walked in and asked what was wrong. I expected to hear that her lover had been fitted with concrete shoes. It was worse.
They aren't going to pay us, she sobbed.
Not going to pay who? I asked.
Motherfuckers aren't going to pay me. I was raised better than that shit.
Back then, I carried a blank pistol with me. For protection, of course. Shows how ignorant I was. So I got the gun, busted into the club's office, and ordered the motherfuckers to give me the money they owed me. I talked my best black shit. That usually scared the average white motherfucker. But you know how it is when you do something and the motherfucker don't react? And you can feel there's something wrong. And you got the gun. You think there's something wrong. There's some look missing in this motherfucker's face. I'm sure those men are there today laughing.